me talk about BK and epsilon prime epsilon. Okay. Okay. And this project has been there since 1999. That's what I believe. And so it has been about 5 years have passed doing this work. And so basically, it's a brief summary of the history and also some recent progress in an epsilon prime or epsilon. Basically, that's the thing. And as you can see, there has been a lot of people involved in this project at the beginning stage or later stage, and Steve and me are still working on it very much. And basically, the focal point, this is the sort of remind you what's the meaning of epsilon prime or epsilon in experiments. And basically, it's defined like that. And the omega is very famous, the delta equal half rule. And there has been two experiments, high statistics experiment at KTAB at Fermilab and NA48 at CERN. And their value is about, this morning I updated it, and so it should be pretty precise from the website of KTAB. And so this is the most updated results from the experimental side. And it's non-zero and non-trivially positive. That's the fact, actually. 10 to minus 4 is from the beginning expected. That's the order of magnitude we theoretically we know. But actually, 20 or 16 is rather large number. So experimentally positive and very large number, that's what they expect. And basically, the main goal of this staggered epsilon prime epsilon project was, at the beginning, we tried to check the results obtained using the quenched domain wall fermion. And they obtained already a negative epsilon prime epsilon. Basically, two group has independently calculated this quantity, CPPAX and RBC. And the next thing is, we want to check the next leading order prediction in the partially quenched chiral perturbation and quenched chiral perturbation. And we want to check all the matrix elements that what's the chiral behavior, basically, in the next leading order. And another proposal is, right now, actually, it's possible to calculate epsilon prime or epsilon in full QCD. More accurately, it's partially quenched QCD. We can calculate it using milk lattices. And one of the major approximation is quenching, basically, and we want to remove it. I think as we go further in this talk, it becomes clear why quenching is such a dramatic, a systematic error in epsilon prime or epsilon. And also, you will pretty soon see that we need to use the improved staggered actions and improve the operators, especially heap or FSL-MBAR schemes, improvement schemes. We need to improve the staggered fermion. That becomes also crucial. So combining all these things, hopefully, if we get a number in partial quenched QCD, we might be able to compare it with the experiments. Then hopefully, it will show us some new windows for new physics. And why staggered fermion? There are many reasons, but it has, on the finite lattice spacing, it has a conserved U1 vector and U1 axial, and the quark mass is completely protected, and so there is no residual mass. There is no additive renormalization for the quark mass, and computationally cheap. It's about factor of 200 faster than domain wall or the overlap. Discretization error is order a square, and so it's very easy to improve. Basically, almost no extra cost if we do it carefully with the heap or FSL-MBAR scheme. It's almost no extra cost. Obviously, the disadvantage is the flavor symmetry, or modern language is called taste symmetry. As if for taste symmetry is broken manifestly, and the operator mixing matrix is about 65,000 operator by 65,000, and that's big. And so non-perturbable renormalization, in principle, one can do, but it's impractical. And so programming 65,000 operator in the code is non-trivial. So
How do you estimate the computational chip factors 50 times 4?
Which one? This one. It's empirical. This 4 is the spin.
Okay.
Spin, there are 4 components, and the 50 is some empirical fact. Empirical fact. I got it. I compared actually the domain or code in RBC, compared that one to my code in staggered fermion and epsilon prime epsilon, and that's the rough ratio I got.
At the same
similar quark masses and you those things. Right.
I mean.
Right. Right.
Maybe your code does not
optimal. the domain code is not optimal. That's what you're saying. I didn't write the domain code.
Your code is too good.
At any rate, first let me start with the unimproved staggered, because that's the place where we started this project. And so, first in 1999, I think we started a perturbative calculation for the unimproved staggered operators. Basically, there are two kinds of operator in four-fermion operators. There are two kinds of diagrams. And the first diagram is penguin diagrams, and there are Kron-Kron diagrams. And the penguin diagram was already calculated in 1993, and it was quite small. It was 2%, and so that's very nice. 2% is very okay. But when you calculate the Kron-Kron diagram for the first time at year 2000, around 2000, you calculated the perturbative correction was actually as big as the tree level. It was 100% correction. Especially if this 100% is those operators of no interest, then it's okay. But actually, the most interesting operator, Q6 and Q8, those operators, the perturbative correction was 100%. So it was very, very discouraging at that point. So the conclusion out of this first study was very clear. We must improve the staggered fermion, both action and operators. And the purpose of the improvement is to reduce the perturbative correction as much as possible. That was the, at that time, that was the goal. And although the perturbative correction is 100%, we performed some numerical study. We actually calculated all the operators and all the contractions for epsilon prime over epsilon. And actually, one thing important we checked was for special operator, which dominates the delta I equal half contribution, is called Q6, basically. For the back parameter calculation for that one, actually in quenched QCD, we have two versions of lattice operator. One is called the Goltermann and Parenti operator. The other is called standard operator. If the difference is small, then it might be okay. But at that time, the difference was almost 100% between them. So what it meant was very clear to us that in quenched approximation, the uncertainty from these operator transcription is too much. Basically, can you conclude anything in the quenched calculation if the difference is this much big? I will get back to these operators later on. And so at this point, I will just to give you the historical reason why we want to improve the staggered fermion and see. I will get back to this point. These two operator is basically essentially the difference corresponds to the quenching uncertainty. Right, I will explain it later. So we observed this large quenching uncertainty at that moment. And so together with this 100% perturbative correction plus this large quenching uncertainty, everything was so unclear at that time. Just this was year 2000 or year 99, something like that. And so after that, it was clear for us that we must improve the staggered fermion. And at that time, in the market, there has been lots of papers about the improvement, basically, and the famous improved action, which is used for dynamical simulation nowadays, ASCTAD, is a combination of these three, and independently, these other possibility was in the market at that time. So the question is, which one is the best improvement scheme? And also, what's the criteria to choose the improvement scheme at that time? That was the issue. It's a kind of, let me explain a little bit. Basically, the old improvement scheme replaced the thin link in terms of the thin link plus plaquette plus 5 link plus 7 link kind of thing. So plus some L positron looks like that, and some combination of these things. So basically, the coefficients or SU3 projection, where to put it in, that's the difference. But it's some combination of these things, and that's the improvement schemes which is going on. So these different things are the different combination of those things. So then each one has their own reason to improve that much, but which one is really best for our purpose was at that moment not that clear. So let me explain what's the main goal. Main goal for us is we want to reduce the perturbative correction. Well, how much? We want less than 10%, basically. If it is bigger than 10%, then it's not that good. We want to reduce it smaller than 10%. That was the criteria. Well, you may say, why? Why 10%? The previous empirical experience with the non-perturbative renormalization, we performed for, say, what is it? Global action, we performed non-perturbative normalization for all the bilinear operators. We learned from the lesson that if the perturbative correction is order of 10% and smaller, then basically one loop correction is very close to perturbative correction. And so there is the non-perturbative normalization and perturbative one loop calculation, there was not much difference. But if it is usually bigger than 10%, then there was a trouble. So that was an empirical criteria for us in mind. So one way to achieve this goal, improvement goal, was we want to suppress the taste-changing interaction of high-momentum gluons interacting with quarks. And basically, the method, technology, is the Shimanchik improvement program. And we want to reduce it as much as possible. And another empirical fact at that moment available was, and Anna Hasenfratz and Knightley, and partly combination of Dr. Toussaint and Kostas Orginos, they have done some numerical work on the pion multiplets. And so they look at the pion spectrums with different flavor structures or taste structures, and they compared it. They knew already that heap or RP smearing gives the smallest taste symmetry breaking. So the symmetry breaking term is reduced most in heap or RP. That was an empirical fact. At the moment, it was available.
I mean, this key idea was, can you define it sort of in a non-perturbative way? I mean, what exactly is it non-perturbative that I am trying to calculate? I want to set to zero by this X factor.
That's right. You remember the Stegold fermion has its doublers. It exists intrinsically.
Non-perturbative is, I'm
explaining in non-perturbative way.
So
these doublers, actually, each one, if you look at it, the contribution from each one is not as small. It's as good as the central region, the physical region. So these extra flavor, what should I call it? These 16 other pores, one of them is physical, and the rest, if we look at it as a side pores, their contribution is not small. So effectively, this suppressing this high momentum gluon means basically these 15 other things, which is non-physical, we want to suppress them and make the physical one more dominant.
Yeah, but that's a perturbative picture, right? Because you think about the free Dirac, and you see the 15, the 16, whatever.
Right.
Now, just totally non-perturbative, you have the biggest computer in the world, and it works instantaneously.
Mm-hmm.
You can tune any knob you want, and which world identity or which identity is it that you want to satisfy so that you are now happy with whatever you did with the text. So what's the non-perturbative definition?
Maybe
you
have the splitting between the masses of the different tastes.
Right. That's the, this is the numerical empirical one.
So you are measuring,
pion multiplex and splitting of pion, if we reduce it as much as so, possible, that so might be a criterion.
Just specific. So you take eta, let's call eta the fermionic fields, and you write some observables made out of these etas. And
what? Eta is not a fermion field, is it?
Well, what do you call them? Chi's. What do you call them? Fermion? Psi. Psi. The things which don't have indices, okay?
Okay.
These are the things that are in the code, right?
Uh-huh.
So you write some observables in terms of them, and uh-huh. you have to calculate, you write observables which have the numbers of pseudo scalars, and you have to calculate all pseudo scalar masses, but are they all stable? They're not really stable.
Mm-hmm. There's yes. a whole set of pseudo scalar masses which are pions, which have the quantum numbers of the pions, but as Steve mentioned the other day, they are split in a particular pattern, which he
It's
the best measure of case symmetry, I think, is the splitting.
I'm asking for a definition of these guys, which is totally non-protonic.
Okay, so you.
Nobody speaks about an unstable particle.
No unstable particles. Okay. There are a bunch of different particles you can make out of chi's. That's what I call it. By putting them either the same side or slightly different sides of the hypercube.
And then they're
all in different lattice. In the lattice, it will use for representations of okay. each stable, that the lattice state in each channel, and we can measure their masses in the continuum. They should become degenerate. If I find a lattice spacing, they're not degenerate because of the space symmetry break.
So the discrete symmetry equivalent makes them stable individually? Mm-hmm. And you have enough discrete symmetry to make how many of them stable?
There are 15, 16 different representations. No, sorry, they're 8 different representations because they collapse. There are some discrete.
No, just the hypercube. You are allowed to use only the hypercube.
Yeah.
Right. No, this is a Euclidean or a Hamiltonian picture?
Euclidean.
So you're using the four-dimensional hypercube.
Well, no, you use the time slice group. So I guess it's Hamiltonian. Okay, sorry. Yes. Yeah. Transfer matrix and color.
Yeah. But, and you still have that much? I mean, in the hypercubic, so you're using just the hypercubic of the sweeping of the hypercubic.
It's big. It's a big discrete group.
Okay. Because so the criterion would be that you have to make them exactly the general.
That's right. Then.
So you have 15 parameters.
Right. So this is the idea, is you really did this four fermion interaction, you really did semantic improvement, like Paul McKenzie and fellows have slowed down a little bit. That's what they had in mind. Can you adjust the parameters and make these particles degenerate?
But I mean, this you cannot do perturbatively, so perturbatively you cannot define the pattern.
Sure, no, but he was asking.
No, I was asking.
Non-perturbative definition, criteria.
I just wanted to have, you know,
something in mind.
Something
here. Yep.
So I wasn't aware that you actually have enough symmetry to make all of this independent and stable, basically.
Yeah.
Too much symmetry.
No, I mean,
you have four. Yeah, I mean, you're
I did.
You're putting four flavors on where you really want to keep less.
Right. No, this is a question of intended for somebody whose intention is to solve a theory with four degenerate flavors and an SU force. First step. At that stage. Really naive stage.
May I go? Okay, thank
Where
you.
Do you want to go? <Just
start>. Okay. Let me go ahead. Okay. So basically, if you remind a little bit, what we are discussing is basically the pion multiplet, they look at it, and the splitting in the pion multiplet was smallest, actually, which is the good measure of the taste symmetry breaking. Is that was smallest for the heap and ape improvement schemes at that time. And so it was an empirical fact. But what we need was, we need more explicit things. And so what we did is we explicitly calculate the one loop corrections to all the bilinear operators for all the possible improvement schemes at that time. So we explicitly calculate them and compared each schemes to each other. And as a conclusion of this work, we observed that FAT7 and HIP or FAT7 bar are the best in reducing the size of the one-off corrections, actually. And this fact, combined with the previous results about the non-perturbative work about pion multiplet, and then numerical work, if I combine these two facts, then actually we choose HIP or FAT7 bar for our numericals. Basically, this was the best choice. The reason why I say FAT7 bar here is because FAT7 bar is cheaper in the dynamical simulations compared to the HIP. So basically, they are essentially the same. And so these are the best scheme we have chosen. So after that, once we choose the improvement scheme, we study a little bit further. What's the properties of these improvement scheme, basically, in the stable fermion languages. And we found a bunch of properties, actually, which is expressed and summarized in these five theorems. And out of these five theorems, what we figured out is actually diagram by diagram, we can calculate the finite correction term at the one-loop level, and they are smaller than the unimproved one. We can, diagram by diagram, we can prove it. And not only that, the SU3 projection, it seems to me, is more like equivalent to the Tadpole improvement for the staggered fermions. And actually, the punchline out of this work was, and so basically, why we do this study? The purpose was we want to simplify the one-loop renormalization for the full fermion operator. And that renormalization, one-loop renormalization, can be simplified just simply replacing the thin-link propagator by the fat-link propagator, basically, and calculate the Feynman diagram, we can do the renormalization. And it simplifies the calculation dramatically in this way. So the first, we draw the diagram for the thin-link, and we know the diagram. Then in that diagram, we just replace the thin-link gauge field propagator by the fat-link propagator. Then that actually do the job. And one can prove it, actually, at one loop level.
Propagated, you mean link?
Right. Link has a gauge field in it, and that gauge field makes the propagator.
The propagators with those links.
Yes, yes, okay. Yes, yes. So if you replace...
I'll stop to finish the sentence, but I had a question. So what is the relation between the smallness of the one-loop correction and the splitting of the pseudoscalar bosons?
Oh, that dialectically is not clear, isn't it? Empirically.
Different thing. So you said before you should reduce the flavor symmetry breaking by making the mass splitting of the pseudoscalar small, and now you say, okay, forget it. This is more, it is difficult. So let's do something different.
No, that's not the case. Actually, the point was, from the beginning, was we want to reduce the perturbative correction. Do you remember that at the beginning, unimproved staggered fermion has a huge perturbative correction, 100%? Basically, our criteria is we want to reduce that at least 10% or smaller.
This is okay, but so to say, now you give up the other. Maybe you are just inducing huge splitting in the pseudoscalar masses by this criteria.
No, this is not a new criteria.
We are saying that these two independent things, are they related?
Yeah, sure. The criteria is the same because basically,
in the same case, you want to
restore flavor changing interaction, if we suppress it, then the flavor symmetry breaking effect is reduced by that much. So either we do perturbatively, we reduce it, the effect shows up in non-perturbative way in a pion multiplet, the effect is the same. It's connected.
Okay, that's already something.
The underlying philosophy principle is the same. You want to reduce the flavor changing interaction.
I see the relation that somehow you want to reduce the flavor symmetry.
And you want.
Still, I don't understand why. Maybe I just. So this is a question.
Right.
Why is it so that if you reduce the one loop correction to 10%, then the flavor symmetry is restored in some perturbative amplitudes? Even this, I don't see. Certainly, I don't see it for the masses, but even, let's say, within a perturbation theory, you would just calculate something and look for the flavor symmetry, not for the one-loop correction of the Z factor.
Ah, now I understand what you want to say. If you
showed how it was the jumps between with large gluon momentum between the doublets, which was the cause of the large one loop corrections,
so it's a two step process.
Right, right. Not only that, I think if you actually look at two more transparency later on, you will see the effect of that on how it shows up in perturbation, actually in dramatic way. And at any rate, this we studied a little further on this property, and in the end, this property actually renormalization can be done by just simply replacing the thinning propagator to the fattening propagator. That simplified the actually analytic calculation a lot. And we performed a four-Fermion operator normalization for the full heap and fast seven bar improvement schemes. And this is the results. Basically, the number here around 100 corresponds to 100% correction, one loop correction. So as you can see, unimproved case, these operator has a correction size about 100% there without tadpole improvements, naively. So it was pretty bad at that time. And using HIF and FAST7-bar, first that correction term reduced dramatically. It's a lot. And even with the tadpole improvement, as you can see, that it becomes less than 10%, both one. So if we do the tadpole improvement combined with the HIF improvement scheme, basically, it reduced the perturbative correction 10% or smaller than that. So
the diagram to calculate just one loop.
Yes. Exactly. Yes.
Okay.
And
may follow many of them. And
yes, there are many of them. About
A. And yeah. There are constants yield the log A's. And
exactly. Yes. These are not the anomalous dimension terms. These are finite constant terms. So
right.
They are notoriously big for these operators, which are very interesting actually in physically. Both of these operators shows up in QA, Q6, the dominant operator in epsilon prime over epsilon calculation. And so it was very, very bad at that time. But after the improvement, we know how to control them. And
the
temperature.
The big reform is that you have the 16 points in Q.
Right.
Very little space around them to really build up the continuum.
And so the. Right. Those high momentum exchange gluons, basically, which change the flavor. In the stable fermion, those flavor changing interaction was as big as the flavor non-changing physical interactions. So that was the reason why, after this improvement, removing those high momentum and flavor changing interaction, then after that it was controlled in this way. So there was a systematic way of.
I see the point that the gluon of momentum needed
cutoff scale
between two points.
Right.
Is not suppressed as much as you would like it to be by the cube itself. Is that the point? I mean, I'm just trying to get some intuitive feeling where you have 100 and then you go by down. Why did you have to start off having 100?
And so let's say there was a 1.
100 is just, who knows what 100 is. Small.
No. The usual, well, there is a typical feeling that if you're doing Wilson fermions, you wouldn't see things like that.
This is your race
graph
coefficient.
Well, and the reason I was thinking that you were saying is the race
graph. No. This is the one loop perturbative correction. If you do, there is a finite one loop term. G square coefficient. Right. The coefficients of G square was like this. It was big. Right. No. These are just.
You only have the guys that are above a pi that bother you, right? Because a pi is sort of the momentum space scraps out and you starts coming back from infinity.
It's pi.
Sorry.
You're off by a factor of two.
But something like that, right? So there's like a factor of two to the. So I'm looking.
Right. So then you have to imagine that by tap holes of the fermion.
Right.
But that diagram itself then is quadratically divergent, which can't cancels the one over a square that you get from the Hilbert propagator. So that's why it gives a finite contribution.
So smoothing the gauge somehow makes these things dampen them down.
The coupling of those hydrons and gluons to the...
You iron out your gauge.
Yeah, you're playing with the coupling plus
coupling.
Something wrong.
Exactly.
That.
Right. Yep.
But where CH is smaller than CM because the CH includes the hip for fattening of the limbs, is that right?
Right. That's the reason why the tetrapod factor itself is very tiny. But, yeah. At any rate, so we now control the perturbative corrections. And penguin diagram case, as I explained that before, from the beginning, unimproved staggering, it was pretty small. It was 2%. It was very small. And so just the improved staggered fermions, well, what did it turn out? And actually, it turns out to be, the result is, the diagonal mixing turns out to be identical between unimproved and improved staggered operators. The improvement scheme doesn't matter. All the improvement scheme I know, for all of them, actually, unimproved and improved staggered fermion operator, that diagonal mixing was still 2%, exactly the same, no change. And so then you may ask, then what improvement has done? Something should change. What has changed is off-diagonal mixing, on-physical mixing. So this might answer to your question. So this origin of this off-diagonal mixing was because this Fréber-changing interaction was allowed before in unimproved staggered fermions. They are explicitly right now removed. They are killed by the improvement schemes. Then the net effect is the off-diagonal mixing completely becomes zero. And so on-physical mixing, which existed as a lattice artifact before in unimproved staggered, right now vanishes. Doesn't exist anymore. And plus, the net effect of improvement only changes in the higher dimension operator. And so in the level of dimension 6 operator, there is no change. But dimension 8 or higher, that there is a change. So those things are suppressed by cutoff. Who cares? So we don't care. So for the dimension 6 operator of the penguin diagonal mixing, essentially, there was no change in that way. And so improvement only changed off-diagonal plus the high-dimensional operators. So that was the net effect, what happened. So penguin diagram, we calculated basically. What it means is, once we calculate the penguin and Curran-Curran diagram, and we have a complete set of one-loop matching factors for the epsilon prime original. So the only thing missing right now is the numerical number, values of the wing matrix elements. So the next...
What was your statement about the quantum matching factor? That it does depend on the scheme you choose, right? So,
It does depend on the scheme.
Right? And the R or the dimensional.
That's the continuum. Continuum, we choose NDR, for example. Or you can choose the toothed Vetterman or whatever it is.
But this number, you are 119 to...
On the lattice is the lattice regularization plus minimal subtraction. That's it. It fixes the complete normalization scheme.
Minimal subtraction, you specify the scheme.
That's right.
So
it fixes everything.
Number depends on the scheme, right?
Right, and so if we fix the scheme, regularization is lattice regularization and the minimal subtraction. That's the scheme for
the
us on the lattice.
I can't get
you're right. I agree with you. And so it depends on the scheme. What is the scheme you are asking?
So
continuum, it is minimal subtraction in dimensional regularization and NDR scheme. That's the scheme in the continuum.
Right.
On the lattice, the scheme is lattice regularized.
He wants those finishes.
So my finish is why it's so important to have small. I mean, let's say you can change the scheme and you can get this number to zero, right? Apparently, the 110 is very different. That's why I can't use it. But
right.
If it comes to order one, no matter how large or small, it doesn't matter.
Right. And so
I wonder why you are so.
In the same scheme, the number is, if it is too big, the matching is unreliable. But if it is small, matching is more reliable, isn't it?
Yeah.
In the same scheme,
yes.
Right. Scheme is fixed, right?
As long as it's order one, it doesn't matter.
It says if you reduced it to order one, if you, instead of 120 you have only one there, you wouldn't be worried at all, because it's already the noise of the ambiguity of the scheme. Yeah. Yeah. I think you guys would agree.
Right.
No?
Yes, absolutely.
Yep.
So what you're doing is just, the general picture is improving the operators.
Improving operator action? Improving action too?
Action too?
Yes. That's crucial. Both one is crucial.
You know, in the back of the, my mind, since I'm sitting here, I have a false hope, so that's why I'm asking.
So improving the action is very crucial, because the quark mass doesn't be normalized.
The operators doesn't help the false hope at all.
Okay, so after the whole calculation of Potovatu calculation, we have all the matching factors are available, ready, but the missing part was numerical part. We need the wing matrix elements itself, and so we performed the numerical study. This is the first study with the heap staggered fermions, and we started this numerical study at year 2003. And so we used it's a still quenched QCD simulation, and we used the standard Wilson-Prock connection, nothing fancy, and beta equals 6.0. The 1 over A is roughly 1.95 GeV, around 2 GeV. And it was 16 cube by 64 lattice. And we used about 218 gauge configurations. And we used the heap staggered fermions for the valence quark. And the quark mass was around 1/5 of strange quark mass to the 4/5 of the strange quark mass. So that's the roughly quark mass ranges we used for our numerical study. So the first thing I want to show you is B sub K. And basically, essentially, B sub K is a parameter which describes the K-K-bar mixing, neutral K-on system mixing physics, basically. And basically, for B sub K, the study has been done so many times in the past. There has been so many works available. But still, we want to do it with improved staggered to get a better understanding of that, or higher precision. Let me get back to the why it is so important later on. And essentially, if we do the chiral perturbation for this BK with finite volume effect included, then it looks like that. The important thing is this chiral log term, the coefficients is fixed. It's not a free parameter. And the finite volume term, also the coefficients is fixed. So up to that point, it's deterministic. It's already theoretically known. And these G1 and G2 essentially is zero if the volume is infinity. But if the volume is not infinity, they have some finite volume corrections in it. It's complicated function, which has been existed in the literature since the Gesser-Luitweiler's original paper. And these are the higher order correction terms with some unknown coefficients. So that is the form to fit the data. So this is the x-axis is mk square, basically pi on mass square or k on mass square, whichever the one. We are using degenerate quark masses, and so pi on k on we don't distinguish, and in the language they are the same. And y-axis is the b sub k, and we have four data points measurements, and the curve which ends here, before it goes all the way to the chiral limit, that's the finite volume fitting. That's the fitting with the finite volume. And the curve which goes all the way to the chiral limit, that's the infinite volume curve, basically. So as you can see, the finite volume effect, you can see some, in the lightest quark mass, you can see some of the effects, which is something. But in the region where the physical kaon exists, in that region, actually, the finite volume effect essentially is zero. You cannot see it. It's very small, tiny. So, but certainly it affects the chiral limit very much. And as a result of this fitting, in the infinite volume limit, the BK at 2GB we get about 0.578 with a statistical error this much. And this is the systematic error from the truncated G to the fourth order, alpha square order thing we estimated. And the truncated perturbative series gives the actually the highest systematic error. There are other systematic errors, but which are all smaller than this one. So this was the dominant one, and so we included here as the systematic error.
This is the two-loop in Z factor.
Right, yes. Yeah, two-loop in Z factor. Oh, we didn't calculate it. What we have done is BK has four independent channels internally in it. And each channel, we added alpha square with the coefficients plus, minus there. And we independently tried all independent channels, add some more, subtract. And we tried all of them, and we choose the largest one. So it's a rough estimate. It's an approximate estimate, but I think it's in the right ballpark.
But this is how the real, of course, remain.
Right, it maybe
could ask what is this real loop. So I mean, this sort of a perturbative ingredient is
right.
Is the largest error.
Right. 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 Right.
It's also crunching, as Chris
there is a crunching error which is subtly suppressed, because you have no idea what it is.
Right.
It's BK quenched.
Right. It's a BK quenched systematic. Right.
But experimentalists need to be told that for some of their re-lattice papers. And
oh, it says very clearly,
what's the problem? They should allow them.
So that much is the systematics.
So this is a simple question. This was done at 1A, at one lattice spacing?
Yes. Yes.
So you have no idea whether this B1 and B2 that you are fitting really scale correctly with A.
That's right. That's right. Right. Yeah.
But you haven't seen that change.
Yeah, not yet. Yeah. So the renormalization group invariant BK is about 0.8. Let's say this much. And the BK value in the chiral limit was 0.314. And this value actually can be checked against the analytic calculation of 1 over NC, maybe Herbert's favorite topic. And that 1 over NC calculation, actually, the value was 0.3 plus minus 1, roughly, plus minus 0.1. So it's in the right ballpark there, but with some caveats in it. But, this BK value at 2GB is consistent with the JLQCD results at zero lattice spacing, not the 2GB values, using unimproved staggered fermions. Basically, it's consistent if we remove the A square effect from their fitting measures. But if we remove alpha square, basically their data, if I show you, they do fit in alpha square and A square in both. These are the JLQCD results. And they fit both in A square and alpha square. But if we remove A square effect, that's consistent to our values. But if we remove alpha square, they are rather inconsistent. And their finite value at finite lattice spacing is there, and we can compare this value to ours. As you can see, at finite lattice spacing, it doesn't agree. But since our results is improved staggered fermion results, it's rather more consistent in their continuum extrapolated values. So this is empirically showing that it actually improved staggered fermion reduces A square effect to a certain way. So in order to quantify this one, actually, what we need to do is to add a couple of more points in the smaller lattice spacing that is underway, not yet done. So that much is this caveat about the A square effect. And you may ask.
Before you go, can you go back?
Right.
A couple of slides to the graph about the result.
This one?
Yeah. So
there's been this long-standing issue that we can use k to 2 pi of radius 2 to predict bk using color coefficient theory. You get too small.
Right.
So we're not the first to point this out, but all the same is consistent, but you can have that number and also the much larger value for bk that's consistent because there is this big chiral law. And
right, the curvature is essential, right. Right, this curvature
actually,
is...
That's a quench number, but it turns out it's the same parallel quench non quench.
Okay, since you put this, I wanted to ask you, so B1 and B2, you get it from the fit, right?
Yes.
How accurate? So, right,
how accurate? This figure shows it, isn't it? That's
no,
the...
I don't know how much B1...
B0 is this...
I want to know what the error in B1 and B2 are. I mean, it's a three-parameter fit to 4 points. I don't remember.
The error on the point.
No, but B1 is 20%, 30%, 40%.
I don't remember exactly. Yeah, to that.
Not surprisingly, the error on the parallel extrapolated value was pretty big.
You see, it's kind of hard to think about the chiral part without the B1 part because it's so close. It always goes together. I mean, it is what sits inside the log. It is depend on determining the B1. I mean, that's it's x log x plus x. You can't really separate the x from the x log x because it's x alone.
Sure, you pick the scale. I can't
remember. Right. So that's B1. Essentially, the question about the accuracy of B1 is the question about that thing. So if you say that the chiral log is so good, then the B1 should be really...
It's about 1 dB, I mean, in the right units. It comes out...
But it should be sort of accurate in the sense that the fit tells you that there is a B1. If the fit tells you at the end that B1 can be 0.1 or 10, then the fit... Then I would doubt that the fit has told you that there is an X log X. That's...
The fit, but we do not have enough data to show that there is a chiral log. See, there's some evidence for curvature there, but you know, having this chiral log on a quadratic, you can't. So the chiral log is put in because we.
No, I understand, but you put it in, and then the fit still will give you some error on B1 and B2. Okay. If the error was small, then it would be convincing.
But it's relatively small. We can go and look after it.
No, I'm not.
You'll be last.
I'm last. I mean, I don't care. But
back to the fit. Presumably, since it's quenched, it's the same gauge configurations in every point, so you have the correlation between the points. So the curvature is more significant than it looks with those huge error bars, is that correct?
Yes.
Because otherwise you wouldn't
correct.
Have it at all.
I agree. So one thing I would like to remind you guys why BK is so important right now is BK actually constrains the CKM matrix in a very significant way. This is the BK part of the in the CKM space, actually the parameter space. This curve is coming from the BK, and if we determine BK more and more precisely, then actually we can constrain this curve more and more. And these curves compared with the heavy quarks, like BB bar mixing kind of thing, it gives another curve. And combining all these things in the CKM space, it really constrains pretty much. Hopefully, it violates some of them, so CKM unitarity, then we might be able to find some new physics, maybe. But that's the goal, basically, of why we are calculating BK. And the second goal to us is BK essentially gives the B1, B2, B9, B10 in delta equals 3/2 channel in epsilon prime over epsilon. So the only missing part is B7 and B8. That's the next slide, basically. Except for that, four of them is determined from BK. So BK, in many senses, is one of the most important quantities in this business. And the next one is this 8 by 8 representation. Basically, there are two operators which belongs to this representation, Q7 and Q8, and which dominates the delta equals 3/2 contribution and epsilon prime over epsilon. And let me go to that ring matrix elements. there are Q7 and Q8 belongs to 8x8 representation of SU3 left cross SU3 right. And this operator should satisfy, if the, this representation is good, there is a word identity between the ratio of the delta equal half and delta equal 3/2 amplitudes in the chiral limit should be equal to 2. And so this word identity should be satisfied if it is, everything is good. So sort of checking this word identity gives us an idea how good is the calculation of improved stable fermions, in a sense. So the Quent-Keiler perturbation, this work is done by Jack Rahal and Amar Jisoni, and actually they give a higher order correction in these two. Actually, that looks like that again. And so these three of the m square log m square term, the coefficients is fixed. It's not a free parameter. So the reading term and next reading term is constrained right now. It's significant constraint. And there is not much freedom here. Can the Stegall fermion satisfy this much? This is for Q7. As you can see, it within about 1 second, basically what, let me explain a little bit what is a fitting. We put C here, C0 instead of 2. And so we want to see whether that two number 2 shows up correctly or not. And that's the business here. And if I fitting, basically, it's about 1 sigma away. But it's Q7, it's close to 2 that much with improved stagger. And it's less than a sigma. It's about half sigma away for Q8. So basically, improved staggered fermion, this chiral perturbation region for the time being is even not staggered chiral perturbation. It's just a continuum chiral perturbation theory. And the improved staggered fermion satisfies this word identity with this much precision in the chiral limit. Well,
what was the solid line in the center line?
Center line is the center field, and this edge line is the error bar.
And what was the, I mean, the formula you saw?
Oh, this difference is one of them is Q7 operator, and the other is Q8. So both one should satisfy this word identity. In the chiral limit, it should be exactly 2. So.
I think he's asking what the fit function is.
What is the question?
No. The previous line, OK, there's an exact and new form. Right.
Fit function. And so instead of putting 2, I put C0 and try to determine C0.
OK. And then what's the C1 and C2?
Oh, C1 and C2 is a free parameter. Okay.
I mean, you know, fit. I mean, then
yeah. I don't remember the numbers, but it was pretty small.
Very small.
Yeah, I believe so. It's not that big. And they shows that this much agreement, and actually the when I first looked at it, I even by myself was surprised, but. This is not a staggered chiral perturbation result even, but it goes to 2, and actually even we can constrain this 2 and do the fitting and it fits. So
okay. What you are plotting is the singlet is instead of 2.
Yeah, instead of 2, we put a free parameter C0 there. And it's a three parameter fit, basically.
C2, it's probably the left-hand side.
And the C0 is what you were showing.
This, no. It's a fit, the whole fit, curves. In the chiral limit, whether it goes to 2.
You have just the function.
Right.
You have only 4 data points. You have 4 data points, and then you have key counters.
Right.
Yeah. If I heard what Steve was saying the other day, if you do staggered chiral perturbation theory at finite lattice spacing rather than a continuum, then the curvature all goes away. Because the A, non-zero A, just wipes out the log, right? So you should get a straight line, you get 1.8.
Yeah.
It reduces it. How much it does in this case is unclear.
Right.
Depends how much if the gold standard is going on. To be done.
Yeah. To be done.
To be done, right. Let us see.
You should say that this stuff is preliminary.
Right. Well, preliminary, but.
5 years down and 5 to go.
Right. At any rate, so it's because this was a good thing to check for Q7 and QHNR, basically, how can I make some sense out of it? You know, the first thing is check the world identity. So this is the first try in this channel with the improved staggered, how much it can give us as with some credits on it. And that was it. And another thing we tried was this operator, k to pi amplitude in Q8, delta equals 3/2 channel. This channel is dominant in the delta equals 3/2 contribution to epsilon prime over epsilon. And the chiral behavior, intense chiral perturbation, supposed to be like that again. And this two is not a free parameter again. And it's fixed. And if I fit, that looks like that. And the chiral limit value is about -8.5. And that was what we obtained. In order to check this value, again, we do play the same game. This Q8 delta equal half channel is completely negligible operator, and basically nobody pays much attention because this contribution, delta equal half contribution to epsilon prime over epsilon, is so negligible, it's so small, it's essentially almost zero. So, however, from this channel, thanks to it's connected to the world identity, delta equal 3/2, we can take advantage of that fact, and we can have a look at this channel. And we looked at it, the calculation is way different. This has subtraction terms and all kinds of complications are in it. And I will get back to this point, what the subtraction means actually later on. And the chiral behavior looks like that. Again, the coefficients of the leading chiral log is not a free parameter. It's known analytically. And if we fit it, it goes to about 17. And so -17. And so the factor of two world identity was still valid in this one, and so we can double check it. So our value, we believe, have certain credits in that category. That much is the delta equals 3/2 channel. Basically, delta equals 3/2 channel is dominated by this operator, Q8. And this is the results. And so that's the message I want to give you. And it's checked against the world identities and Q6. Q6 is rather preliminary, but let me show you. Q6 operator, it belongs to 8 by 1 representation of SU3 cross SU3 right. And this Q6 dominates the delta equal half contribution to epsilon prime over epsilon. And the chiral behavior, we just fit it into this free parameter form. And that Q6, as I explained, this is the place where I explained the difference between the standard operator and Goltzmann and Prandtl operator for Q6. So basically, the Fraber symmetry of the quenched QCD is SU3/3, and the Fraber symmetry of the full QCD is SU3. So one may choose an operator as a singlet in SU3 right group, or one may choose an operator as a singlet in SU3/3 group in quenched QCD. And so this much is ambiguity. So the standard operator means it's a singlet in SU3 right-hand group. And Goltzmann and Parenti operator means it's, the operator is a singlet in SU3/3 group. So graded algebra group. So the difference between them is this much dramatic. So even in improved staggered Fermion calculation, as you can see, the standard operator or the data is way smaller than -10. It's way smaller. If you do brutal linear fit still, it goes somewhere there. And for Goltzmann and Parenti operator, it's way above 10. And if you do the linear fit, it goes somewhere like that. So the Goltzmann and Parenti basically operator gives a significantly higher value in Q6 channel. And another thing you immediately need to notice is this matrix element in chiral behavior supposed to be proportional to m square, the m pi square, the mkn square. And this chiral behavior in staggered fermion is guaranteed in a sense. As you can see in the data, they are just finite. But in the case of domain one, it blows up because of the, it has a residual symmetric breaking effect that gives a pore, 1 over m squared pores. So the same plot, if I plot with the domain one data, then it blows up. So the Steger fermion, actually, the exact chiral symmetry at finite lattice spacing pays off. So,
right. To be clear, it's not exactly convincing from our data alone.
Yeah. Right.
You can say the right-hand block might be blowing up. So.
Where is the right-hand
block? No, 1 over m you cannot fit, isn't it?
I don't understand.
But you present these two plots as evidence that crunching is important because...
Yeah, this difference, let me go back, is this. Basically, one of the operator belongs to a singlet in SU3. The other operator is a singlet in SU3 bar 3.
You wouldn't have the other if you blow up the crunch.
Right. So this is a pure quenching effect. And so the quenching effect that much, actually, it's dramatic. And
I'm kind of confused. In quenching, how can you know how to take account of quenching, I mean, without doing a dynamical calculation. I mean, you're saying you can use one operator or another operator and you can't tell the difference, but I'm missing something.
So in chiral perturbation, if you try to see the chiral behavior, right, it's way different.
It's nothing to do with quenching. It's just how do you map a particular continuum operator into the quenching
approximation?
Right. Two ways to do it. Okay.
Two alternatives.
Because they are different representations, you have to
right.
Combine the fields
and right.
The weights sort of in the outpoints then it become the same thing.
And you don't have to take these ghost fields into account because these are the sources.
Right.
Okay.
All right. No, this was with, I mean, the other guy was not a singlet under the full SU3/SU3, so I guess it transforms non trivial.
That's right. It's a mixture of singlet and non singlet. Yeah. Right. Okay. Right.
Why you said in the domain one it blows up?
Oh, because it has a very big, the residual breaking effect you can see in there. And so the Q6 operator as a function of M square, Q6, this the same thing. The same thing, you cannot draw like this. It just blows up. So.
I don't know.
Right.
They are also as different from each other in the domain one.
I don't believe so.
So
they are different in the same direction. they're different in the same direction. And I think the effect is as big as this. But on the other hand, look at the
others. Right. The problem with the Q6 channel is the statistics, really. We need more data. We are doing that, and so don't worry. We are calculating some more. it's a question of computing time, not a question of physics.
Oh, yeah.
So,
excuse me. Why don't you have a same
roll-up? I didn't understand the question.
Because of taste breaking, you are super scale, non Gorston model. Other than, besides,
there is an exact world identity which corresponds to the continuum world identity on the lattice. Steger fermion world identity exists.
So
and according to that world identity, it should go exactly mk square on the Steger fermion.
Okay, so you use the
So at the finite lattice spacing, we are expecting that it has a correct chiral behavior.
Okay, so your external pi on
the same Right. Right. And we expect that exact chiral behavior shows up in this channel. No question. So we don't have any residual mass effect. So thank you. Okay. And basically what I try to explain is this solve means actually Q6 operator is calculated through this process. And so that if we look at actually what we calculate on the lattice is we calculate these 8 diagrams and I diagrams and subtraction diagram, and the coefficients of subtraction diagram is determined from these 3 diagrams, and this cross means the derivative with respect to quark mass and kind of things. So the subtraction means actually, without the index of subtraction, basically we are calculating this. But subtraction means we calculate all of these things to determine that matrix elements, and it's non-trivial business. And let's go to the epsilon prime over epsilon. This is preliminary, but the theoretically, epsilon prime over epsilon has a known coefficients, has a delta equal half contribution, delta equal 3/2 contribution. They are destructively interacting, which interfere with each other. And delta equal half channel has a Wilson coefficients and the matrix elements at the same scale, but it itself doesn't know any of these matching scales. 1 minus omega, this omega is the isospin breaking effect, and 3/2 channel, the same structure essentially, and with the known coefficients, and basically that's what we are calculating, basically. So let me first show you. So there is no contribution from Q1 and Q2, the current operators. The reason is there is no loop correction, these things. So three-level operators, and they don't have a CP violation. CP violation is a loop corrections, and so delta equal half is dominated by Q6, and 3/2 is dominated by Q8. And the reason why I showed the linear fit, and this is the fitting in the linear fit, the main reason is because this is the one what RBC or the, what is it, the CPPEX people has done, essentially. They have a quark mass, a little bit heavier quark masses, and it corresponds to a linear fit in our data, actually. And if I do that, the Q6 dominates and looks like that and have a value around 6 or 7, somewhere there. And if we do chiral low fit, it essentially goes to 0. And the error bar is big, and that's the problem. But that's the standard operator. And the Goltermann and Parenti operator, the Q6 is significantly higher, as you can see. It's almost 12, something like that. And the total sum is above 10. This is, again, linear fit. So in order to compare to their values, I did that thing. Chiral low fit, it goes almost to 25, something like that, with a huge error bar. But Goltermann and Parenti operator gives a significantly higher value in Q6. And this is the delta equals 3/2 channel, the same thing. And the Q8 dominates, the rest is minor. And the value is roughly minus 8 to 10, around there. Park, and then this is very preliminary. We are still doing the detailed analysis for Q6 right now. That's underway, and Q6, the actually there is a non-trivial issues we have to dig out right now, and so it's preliminary still. This number might change, but standard operator, we got minus 16.7 with as much error bar. It's still consistent with the RBC and CPPEX. And Goltermann and Parenti case, we get positive values, which is 17 plus minus 14.5.
Can you remind me what RBC and CPPEX got?
They got 3 or minus 7 or 3, minus 3, with the errors as much of the size. And their value is still consistent. Actually, if I do linear fit, it falls on the all three value falls on top of each other. So if I follow their fitting is just brutal linear fit. There is no chiral or sensitive thing. So if I do just the brutal linear fit, then they are on top of each other. So it's consistent, really. I checked many channels. So the RBC and CPPEX tried the standard operator, and the Goltermann and Parenti operator gives a positive. And as you can see, the quenching effect flips the sign. And I don't think this sign change will change the story, even though I do the more detailed study on Q6. So
that's all Q6 that's doing.
Right, the difference is all Q6 right now. And so the uncertainty is in Q6. Even though I dig out this alpha and S, the business of Goltermann and Parenti, and if I dig out all those things, still the sign will not change. So the important thing is this much is the quenching effect. So So we have to do unquenched simulation, basically partial quenched. So that's what stuck most of the conclusions out of this business. So summary and conclusions, again, the HIF and FAST7-BAR improvement scheme resolves the long-standing problem of large perturbative corrections in unimproved staggered fermions. And the perturbative calculation of matching factor for HIF FAST7-BAR is extended right now to the current-current diagrams and penguin diagrams. And this allows us to fully match between lattice and continuum matrix elements at the one-off level. And the size of one-off correction is right now under control, and they are around 10% or smaller. And we've performed a numerical study in quenched QCD using HIP staggered fermions. And the main approximation is quenching, and the chiral perturbation, it depends on the observable. Actually, we use some leading order, some next leading order. And the Goltzmann and Palanti method gives a positive epsilon prime epsilon. And the standard method gives negative epsilon prime epsilon right now. And so the uncertainty from the quenched approximation is so large as to flip the sign of the epsilon prime of epsilon. And we are in the middle of extending the current calculation to include more quark masses and higher statistics, basically. We want to extend. Basically, we try to double the statistics right now. And another thing is, in order to constrain the form of the fitting function, we need some staggered chiral perturbation results, which is tough, actually. Even the continuum calculation was tough. There has been only one group who has done the full set, the Jack Rayhorn and Amarjit Soni. So it's tough business, but somebody has to do that. And we need to check the final fermion effect. Basically, this is another thing we need to calculate, 1.6 fermi to 2.4 fermi. Even 3.2 fermi will be very welcome to us. And we need to extend it to weaker gauge coupling to check the scaling variation. According to our BK study and comparison with the JLQCD results, it was very small. And so we expect that the scaling variation is small, but we need to prove it. So we need these things. And we need to calculate the epsilon prime of epsilon in partial QCD, actually. What we are thinking is mixed action. Basically, ask Ted C quark and the HIP valence quark. We want to do the measurements on the milk gauge configuration. That's actually for the BK. It's underway already. We have some preliminary data available already. And we need to extend the numerical study next reading order in chiral perturbation. The full set next reading order is non-trivial job, but we need to do that. And so current calculation is a leading order, next reading order combination. It's some leading order, next reading order. But in order to extend everything to the next reading order, we need more elaborate calculations. But these are the things. Thank you very much.